Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prusgintas.
We come to you once a week here from the studios of KHOI Community Radio. We are around our kitchen table. We talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions, and we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donald on a Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. For more information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or call the pub and ask for Marcus or just drop on by.
Yes, yes. Well, welcome. Welcome to our kitchen table. This is a brand new year starting out.
Oh, happy new year, 2020 and all that. This is supposed to be a big deal.
It is supposed to be a big deal.
It better be a big deal. We need all the help we can get.
We took some time off over the holidays, and we ate some really good holiday food. But that's what we do, and we had fine time in our kitchen. We are back. We are back here at the Donald on a Kitchen, and here we go again for a new beginning of Donald on a Kitchen shows. Today, on the Donald on a Kitchen, we'll be discussing kind of the future of food.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and it looks
it's
like
it's a brave new world, Laura.
Oh, my. There's some things that I'm going, oh, my goodness. But you have to remember that humans are always kind of experimenting and trying new things.
Yes,
but
we have this human cleverness factor here.
Oh, cleverness. Mm-hmm, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, and we hear about this stuff called Beyond Meat. And, that sounds good, Beyond Meat. Now, what could possibly be beyond? But as you said, Donna, we are clever. And Donna's been doing a bunch of research into this very topic.
Yes, and I have opinions about this. Okay.
This will be good. This is kind of the Donald on a Kitchen update on the food of the future and the Beyond Meat and what the heck is going on sort of topic today. So, Donna, take it away.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm going to launch with two rather overarching principles. And one of them, when I use that phrase human cleverness, it's something I picked up from Wes Jackson at the Land Institute. And he and Wendell Berry, they have been on about this a lot. We are creative creatures, but, we're still nature is a very complex thing, way more complex than our human cleverness brains can actually fathom. And so we often invent things and create things and think these are really hot new ideas. And then sooner or later, they need the test of time. Sometimes we're very correct and sometimes we make I guess that didn't work the way we thought it did because, we didn't factor in some either thing that we scientifically did not understand yet or some new frontier that, we just hadn't thought about. So this human cleverness thing is we have to be careful, right? And one time I was with Wes and Wendell and they did a conference they called it the ignorance-based conference, and they talked about this cleverness versus our ignorance and that in some ways, though we know a lot, there's so much bigger amounts of things in the universe that we do not know and we do not understand. And so as Wes said, let's go with our long suit, which is actually ignorance. So some humility is in place here. So this is a kind of been a guiding principle for me. I'm in good company with Wes Jackson and Wendell Berry here on this. So
three cheers for ignorance or admitting ignorance.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Three cheers for humility, right?
Humility,
okay,
yes.
Okay, right. And the marketing hubris that can happen because somebody's going to make a quick buck on a new idea. So that is the overarching thought that brings a lot of skepticism to my years of experience in the food industry, right? So now I'm going to tell a little story. This is Lynn Clarkson, who's probably one of, if not the largest grain dealer. He's located in Illinois because they get a lot of grains and they send those barges of beans and grains down the Mississippi, and they go all over the world. So Lynn told me this story. He, you know, he is from Illinois. He's a, you know, good Midwestern farmer, ex-farmer, businessman, and a very sensible fellow. So this is Lynn Clarkson. He told me a few years ago the Japanese Minister of Agriculture was paying him a visit because, of course, Japan imports a lot of organic soybeans, right? So Lynn learned that the Japanese visitor's next stop was to visit Monsanto in St. Louis, which is just a hop, skip, and a jump from where Lynn Clarkson is, right? So he asked, could I come along with you on your visit to Monsanto? And the Japanese Minister of Agriculture said, why, yes, of course. So they go and they tour Monsanto, and, you know, there's a lot of deference here because, after all, this is the big deal of Japan, and imports and exports are, you know, this is – we're talking global businessmen here going on. And so the Japanese Minister of Agriculture says to them after the tour, this is remarkable. I'm very interested in what you're doing. This is – you know, this is this GMO stuff and the science behind it and the quantity of agriculture that you're producing. You know, yes, we need to think about all these things, and thank you for the tour. However, please call me in 30 years. So basically what he was saying is this is quite possibly fabulous stuff. Our country, Japan, is not going to eat this until we've had a generation and one half of use within the human digestive tract, basically. It's like, yeah, this may be good, but, you know, we're going to apply what we call the precautionary principle. Let's wait and see if this really is a good thing. This is a novel technology. It's not something that the human biome has had experience with for thousands of years. So let's give it at least 30 years. And to this day, Japan does not grow genetically modified anything in the country. They will import products that have it in them, but they must be clearly labeled. So this is a story of a country that is careful in its selection of new technologies. And I think there's some wisdom in that. So with an eye towards that, what we're going to talk about today in the future of foods is the new wave coming of cultured meats, you know, bio-fermented this and that. And
things are calling meat that really is not meat at all.
Well, it's questionable if it's meat. Is it meat? Isn't it meat? You know,
okay.
With the standards that we have for judging these things, it can be called meat, right?
Oh, all right.
And a big issue is how to name it and how to label it, and it's going all over the place. But it is something that is popping up. You can certainly buy it locally. It is on the market already.
First, what is it? I know there's a lot of variations on it, but what are some of the things that are showing up?
Well, there's several technologies that are going. So the main ones that are out there right now are something by a company called Impossible Foods and another product from something called Beyond Meat. These are two companies. But I'm telling you, it's been a big buzz. Nestle and companies are producing foods that look and often taste like meat. Tyson and Cargill are rushing to invest. Some companies that used to be called, I think I could be mixing these companies up, so if I've made a mistake, don't hold me to this, but something like Purdue, which used to be called a meat company, is now, I believe, this could be Tyson or Cargill, they're kind of interchangeable in my brain, excuse me, but they are now calling themselves protein companies.
Oh.
So the meatless companies are touting that their plant-based products, are planet-saving solutions, right?
Well, that's a pretty big claim.
Exactly. Huh? Well, yeah, I mean, the good news is it does focus on some of the egregious aspects of our food system in terms of creating greenhouse gases. And meat and dairy are definitely, and I'm going to put a caveat in here, the way they are currently produced is producing all kinds of environmental issues, from effluent, from CAFOs to, you know, it's just, it's out of hand here. So I'll just start with my takeaway on the whole thing is I think if we eat a little less meat, we might be better off. But for those that don't want to reduce meat or, you know, and they are not concerned about their environmental footprint, well, you know, so the big selling point is that if you eat Impossible Burgers or Beyond Meat Burgers, you will be environmentally correct. Which is a very important thing to consider. You know, it is, you know, they're talking about, so here's a little quote from an article. It's everywhere, but how good is it for us? On the face of it, a world with less meat brings a host of potential benefits. Reduced climate emissions, chief among them. Meat and dairy production accounts for 14.5% of all human-made greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, that is a controversial figure. It's close to accurate. I've seen higher numbers, lower numbers, depending on how you're calculating it. But here's another aspect. Less meat would also mean fewer antibiotics because, of course, a lot of antibiotics are used in meat production, and we are beginning to have terrible problems with antibiotic resistance. Okay, those are two good things that would come of eating less meat. Mm-hmm. So globally, you know, 50 billion animals are killed each year for us to eat. The U.S. alone has just under 3 million cows slaughtered each year. But while meatless meat is helping to raise the profile of the climate impacts of meat, experts are warning it is not a silver bullet for creating healthy and sustainable diets. Different issue. Mm. Environmentally, yes. Healthy and sustainable diets, separate issue. Most agree that by choosing a meatless burger option over a meat burger is better if you want to reduce your environmental impact. But they warn these burgers will not save the earth as one company promises.
Because certainly, all right, so they don't come from animals, but they come from someplace. You can't make a product out of nothing.
Right. It is highly processed. Ah. Okay. But that being true, they found that processing meatless burgers generates 90% fewer greenhouse gas emissions, uses 93% less land, and requires almost about half as much energy as producing beef. Okay? Now, this is conventional beef. This is not your grass-fed. That's a whole separate environmental issue that we have talked about. If we have time in this show, I'll point out those differences, too. They do, however, they're based on soy.
So the soy needs to be grown.
Right.
And harvested.
Okay. Some of these companies are Beyond Meat uses pea protein, okay? Big soy monocultures are also bad for the environment, but maybe not as bad as meat. You know, this is like a bad, worse and worst, you know, sort of thing. Impossible Foods, that's one of the major companies, has argued that soy is a high-yielding crop and a good source of protein, that it sources from the U.S. to avoid any links to deforestation in the Amazon. They are selling theirs all on environmental principles, mm-hmm. which we all know is really, really, really important, okay? They say soy has a tiny fraction of carbon footprint compared to slaughtering animals. Well, here we are in the soy-producing capital of the U.S. I would say it has its problems, too, as we look at nitrate leaching and other problems that we have here in Iowa. Research has found that a switch away from meat and dairy would have transformative potential benefit in terms of climate emissions, as well as land and, here we go, big Iowa issue, freshwater demands. However, the more important thing would be instead of – it's like a halfway measure, okay? So, which means it could be better than nothing. However, there are other things. There are the nutritional equivalents. these products are not nutritionally equivalent to meat in terms of protein, as far as we know. Okay. That's still a big issue. There's not a lot of science on it yet. People are muttering about it. The other thing is the footprints of the processed products, these Beyond Meat products, is still much greater than if you simply eat, meatless burgers used to be a kind of, I've been eating them and making them for 30 or 40 years.
Veggie burgers.
Yeah, veggie burgers. You know, you'd cook some brown rice till it's really soft and some really soft beans, and you mush them together with some herbs and garlic and spices, and you make a meatless patty. Right?
Sounds good.
And some of them are good. Or another option is you take a portobello mushroom cap and you marinate it in garlic and soy sauce and you grill it up, and it's really good. Now, these unprocessed, lower on the food chain products beat out this meatless stuff by a long shot nutritionally and environmentally.
Oh, really?
Okay. We've had these options around forever. Okay. You know? So here's another little quote. A plethora of meatless marketing has led people to think that the meatless burgers are, quote, just squished plants rather than processed foods. We should avoid rushing to embrace, this is from Food and Water Watch, embrace meatless alternatives as a healthy option, she warned. Yes, meatless meat is the lesser of two evils. So if you're going to eat a burger, eat a plant-based one. But we should be questioning why we are eating all this fast food.
So why, question here from the other end of the table. If we already have, I like veggie burgers, they're good, they're fine. What is the advantage to supposedly processing them even more?
Well, there is a company that's been around for a long time. Morningstar Farms has had these kinds of products in the freezer for years and years and years. They are still, I think, they don't taste like meat exactly. But, you know, if you pile on the ketchup and the mustard and the lettuce and the mayo, you're going to get that kind of hamburgery thing. It's just that these Beyond Burgers are really close to meat tasting.
Oh, okay.
So the people that have not been convinced to eat these things will be more, you know, it's like maybe for some people this is the next best step. Uh-huh. Okay, yeah. But ultimately, here's another quote from the Food and Water Watch people. The closer consumers get to eating whole foods, those that have been processed as little as possible and are free from additives and other artificial substances, the better it will be for their health. Okay, so in the past, a veggie burger could be as simple as grains and beans mushed together, but here they're adding in lots of fats and oils and things. You know, I mean, you just have to read the labels, right? Okay, so these new meatless things they take a lab cultured piece of either. As much for chicken, it could be a piece of a feather or a small tissue. It does not kill the animal. But they take something from the animal, and then they DNA it or whatever they do, and then they build it on some matrix. I mean, it's a complicated, highly technological
So we're talking a different thing here. We're talking starting out with meat DNA.
Yes, that's how they do it.
Okay.
Oh, I mean, that's how they make it taste like fish. They take something from the fish and they replicate the DNA and they grow it on something called a protein matrix or something like that. And they do have to use some protein form, like either mung beans or soybeans or something like that. It doesn't kill the animal. It's called cell-based or cultured. Here's a little quote from another article. It says, if the new meat being, because there's an argument about what to call this, right? Because the meat people are not happy. So a consumer should have a way of knowing they're eating. Is this a real cow that, you know, humans have eaten for thousands and thousands of years and we know how it's going to perform within our human biome? Or is it... If the new meat being grown is called cell-based or cultures, why shouldn't traditional meat be labeled slaughtered?
Well, okay.
Whatever.
You mentioned how this is going to react in our stomachs. I remember, quite a few years ago now, there was this thing that was going to just be the latest thing to help us all be happy and healthy. It was called Olestra. And what a good idea,
yeah,
folks.
Better than margarine, is a kind of margarine, yeah.
But you didn't make you fat. And
yeah,
it was,
because it had a fat molecule. Here's how it worked. It had a fat molecule in it because it's a fat, right, that basically is indigestible. So it's like you get the taste of fat, but it goes through your digestive system, it comes out the other end untouched. It did, however, cause diarrhea.
I remember Olestra, and it was not one of your happier sort of food moments.
Go back to the whole margarine story. This is something we all grew up with. Okay, and I was from a dairy farming family, so in my house, margarine was a dirty word. But margarine was, you know, it's better than butter, it's cheaper, it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, of course, we find out years later that saturated fats cause heart disease. Okay, that's another aspect of human cleverness. But I'll tell you, a lot of people made a lot of money by selling margarine. We need to be skeptical about this, folks. Mm-hmm. I'm not being a curmudgeon here.
Well, we're dealing with human cleverness, and we should include a little bit of human humility. And I just wonder how this stuff is going to sit in my stomach. I want to remind people that this is KHOI. This is Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. We are talking the future of
food.
And, there's lots to talk about yet. Stick around. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, and we are starting off the new year with a bang here. We're talking about
the future of food.
We're talking the future of food, and the powers that be are always looking for something bigger.
Innovation.
Bigger and better. And let's just kind of consider what we're going to have as an option for our tummies in the coming years. We talked about Beyond Meat, Impossible Meat, not quite meat.
Impossible. It's an impossible burger.
Oh, well, okay.
It is impossible meat,
well,
right?
Well, it is, but you know, we can sort of digest it. It sounds good and
tastes good, apparently.
Well, yeah, okay. Well, it's
and
not.
And it's already available.
Well, there you go. So there are other ways that people are trying to improve things here.
The other technology that's heating up is dairy.
Oh.
Right. Now, it's not created the same way. It's made with microbial fermentation.
Oh, yum.
So there's a company called Perfect Day, a startup, is producing milk proteins via microbial fermentation minus the cow. And they plan to expand into animal-free milk fat and new-to-the-world fats. fats that could replace coconut and palm oil in plant-based burgers and other products. So, Perfect Day from Berkeley, California, they teamed up with Archer Daniels Midland to produce and develop a whey and casein proteins on a commercial scale. Those are the basis of the proteins in milk and dairy products.
Huh.
What they're doing is they're using algae. It says algae are excellent at producing lipids, which are fats, but there are also yeast and fungi that can do this, which is why we are, where'd my page go? Why we like to talk about flora more broadly. Microbes are surprisingly efficient at producing fat. And so what they want to do is, in the long term, Perfect Day is looking at producing a variety of fats with different properties that could be used instead of palm oil or coconut oil and also in dairy products.
Is this like a substitute for milk, like lacto-free milk?
And the fats in it. Here's what's kind of there. So they were interviewing these two young men that are doing this, and asked where the Perfect Day dairy would contain conjugated linoleic acid, which is claimed to have health boosts. That's the particular fat that is a higher percentage in grass fed dairy.
Oh, okay.
So it is a good fat. So they ask, okay, is Perfect Day going to make this really good fat? He said, we could make it, but I suspect it's not important for structure or flavor.
Structure or what about health?
Right.
We're not.
Like lactoferrin on the protein side, it's high value but low volume. We are more interested in making large quantities of critical food components that move the needle on global demand and sustainability. So once again, they're looking at touted environmental benefits and disregarding actually some very important things that, you know, need to be done for human health. Here's the alarming bit. Perfect Day has secured self-determined grass, GRAS, that's generally recognized as
safe
status for proteins and has submitted its determination to the FDA. So it is now waiting for a no objections letter, and it will go through a similar process for its fats. That means that they're looking to kind of bypass a lot of scrutiny, saying, oh, yeah, this is something that we've always eaten. Well,
so they can put people label things now.
Yeah.
They can honestly say this product will not kill you. That's
well, the GRAS standard actually means that it's something that is human beings have been eating for a long time.
Oh, okay.
It's used for all kinds of, you know, drug things, and like aspirin, for example, I could be wrong about that, but it means that the FDA considers it's not consequential enough that we have a long history of utilizing these products for ingestion, and they're not going to be bothered regulating it heavily. So to me, this is alarming. These are novel ways of making our food, and they, I think, should be tested and scrutinized.
So is this the kind of thing that is going to be marketed to people who cannot eat dairy, who cannot digest
actually
things?
They can manipulate it, as they already can within, you know, like there's lactose-free milk.
Right,
That's a process that's fairly straightforward. So I'm sure they could assemble the fats and proteins in a way to make a product like this. But it would still have to be marketed to the lactose-free market, whereas they're really actually trying to duplicate in the fermentation processes things that are the same as milk. So if you're lactose, you know, if you need lactose-free, you won't be able to drink this unless they've made something, right? Because they're trying to duplicate milk as it is.
I have a question about this GRAS, generally regarded
as safe.
Okay, that sounds good. Does that actually get tested on people? Like, do people like drink this milk for 30 years and then tell us what's going on? Or how do they test
this? I think that there's generally a historical review. Is this an equivalent to something that we've been for example, recently, this is in the last month or so, I think it's the FDA has claimed that the new CBD oil, the cannabinoid, is not going to be generally recognized as safe.
Oh, really?
They're saying that it produces possibly some liver malfunctions. Now, my take on this is that the reason they're saying that has to do with somebody's going to make a lot of money by using it in pharmaceuticals where it has to have a prescription for it. Because, as a matter of fact, it is a plant that has been used by humans for thousands of years. So you know, this is, okay, one company wants to have that accepted as generally recognized as safe because then they can go ahead and market freely without a lot of regulatory hurdles and scrutiny. Whereas, you know, another industry wants to keep it within their fold, so it'll have to be regulated as a pharmaceutical, right?
Sounds like there's perhaps a lot of decisions made not by testing really well, but kind of on the back of a napkin or in a boardroom.
It's a lot of lawyers a lot of financial calculations and a lot of lobbying going on there.
So that's
as usual.
Yeah. So we're talking butter and probably cheese and things.
Ice cream. Uh-huh. You know, all of these things are going to be. So if you want to be a vegetarian, you could still drink milk, for example.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Because it's not actually coming from a cow.
It's not coming from a cow.
Or vegan even.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
But let's kind of take it easy, folks. See how it goes through the old digestive system. And is it healthy for you? Are you getting good things?
Well, we don't know.
We don't know.
And in my book, anyway, you know, I'm with the Japanese. Let's give it 30 years, which means, you know, maybe my grandchildren, it might be safe for them to eat. I don't really know. I am of the bent where if meat is a environmental issue, we should eat less of it. I totally agree with that. I mean, the other things are that are not considered in this equation is that grass-fed dairy and grass-fed beef has a completely different environmental footprint. There are places where cows and animals actually create topsoil, sequester carbon. They're not in CAFOs, believe me. They're out using rangeland that is not used for producing corn and soybeans. Or, you know, maybe it's too hilly, maybe it's too desert. There are uses where for animals that are environmentally positive. So that is not really being talked about when they're talking about the environmental footprint. They're talking the environmental footprint of the beef and dairy industry are large CAFOs, you know, where the animals are crowded together, where their manure is not used as well, sometimes it is in Iowa. The pig effluent is spread all over the fields for fertilizer, you know. But it's not that the pig is out there, has trotted over the ground, broken up the topsoil, and deposited its poop, which will then compost into good soil and sequester carbon. So when you're talking about the environmental footprint of meat, it does not include pastured animals and grass-fed animals, which would be the same for poultry, too.
Yeah, and be aware these are economic ventures more than anything
else. Yeah. You know, and the world is, at least the Western world, this is, you know, a large portion of the world is still small, family-based, mostly organic grown farmers in third world countries. That agriculture is bigger than you think. It's a lot of food is produced that way. But in our Western countries, this is not the norm anymore.
Yeah. We think big food.
Yeah.
And actually, if you
can't have 1,000 dairy cattle, you can't be in the dairy. You know, it's hard.
Get big or get out.
You
have a few things to say about hyperpalatable flavors.
I want to cover one more thing about the future of food, and this is a flavoring.
A flavoring?
Flavoring. So in the future, the majority, this is from Food Navigator. It's talking about to go, this is the headline, to boldly go Conagen on the future of sustainable flavor production. We don't think about flavors very much in terms of the little ingredients that you have to add, the seasoning. But I will tell you, as a chef, it's sometimes the critical element in making it good. So this article says, in the future, the majority of, quote, natural flavors could be produced from microscopic armies of microbes programmed to convert sugars into target molecules. Rather than devoting vast swaths of agricultural land to growing plants that only contain tiny amounts of the components the food industry is interested in, the synthetic biology is going to take over here. So they say a flavor compound might comprise something like 0.001% by weight of the whole plant. So a really fractional trace amount, yet you're still using land and water and energy to grow the whole plant. Whereas if you make it by microbial fermentation, for example, inserting DNA sequences into a microbe such as a yeast, bacteria, fungi, or algae to instruct it to provide any given flavor during a fermentation process.
Yeah, you got it.
To make a flavor during a fermentation process with sugars as the feedstock, sugar. A bioconversion where you start with a plant extract, say, but then you use enzymes to convert that into a target molecule, you can significantly increase your efficiency and yield, of production on a per acre base dramatically. Plus, you're not using all of the fertilizer, pesticides, water, and so on.
In other words, you wouldn't have an herb garden. You would have little, you know, why go out to all that trouble?
You'd have a little factory that would make it. Some big vat that would ferment it and give you the flavors that you need. And they're able to call this, natural.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know what's natural about it, but.
If you are selling food products, at least in this American market, the flavor of things is kind of important.
If you're making flavors in a fermentation tank, you can make them to order. You don't have to worry about unpredictable weather. That could be climate change, seasonality, political instability, supply chain interruptions, heavy metals, and unexpected pesticide residues that the plants suck up from the soil. This makes it sound really good, doesn't it?
Well, we're talking future of food here. My goodness, this is KHOI. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen by going to the KHOI website, khoifm.org. There's lots of things to look at there. We actually have a website there, recipes, past shows. Yes, you can. Welcome back. Donna Lana Kitchen is talking about the future of food. And there are other ways to eat some really interesting sort of future food.
Yeah, this is a technology. It's not really, it's a technology sort of, but it's not a high-tech technology. It's not a Silicon Valley-ization of food. Insect proteins. Okay, I'm on the bandwagon with insect proteins. They are not novel. Cultures have been eating insects for thousands of years. We know it's fine. We can produce large amounts of protein very economically and in small spaces, right? So, talking about cricket flour, here's the thing. Cricket flour makes a natural, sustainable, and chemical-free animal protein ingredient that is rich in calcium, iron, and B12. It also has high levels of protein, all 9 essential amino acids, and a prebiotic dietary to promote gut health. Okay. Food and beverages fortified with cricket flour can address common nutrient deficiencies in the world, according to the Asian Insect Farming Solutions. So, you know, there are things coming up that I think are really good ideas, and I have eaten them and would eat them, and I recommend that, you know, we consider them. These are generally recognized as safe because we have a long evolutionary history with them.
It sounds like food to me.
Yeah,
let's talk more about crickets. We humans are an innovative lot. We've experimented and tried many, many things. We've learned to eat many, many things. Today, at our kitchen table, is someone who is encouraging us to experiment and broaden our horizons. Shelby Smith. She is a small-scale farmer here in central Iowa, and she is growing a protein product. She has, hang on to your hats, folks, she has crickets for sale. Yes, she does. Shelby, tell me about your farm and your business.
Yeah, so I own Jim and Eat Crickets, which Jim and Eat, so GYM-N-Eat, but yeah, so I raise crickets for human consumption.
That can be done, huh?
That can be
done.
Yum! Yes.
Now, why crickets? Do other people eat crickets?
You know, 80% of the world eats insects.
You're kidding.
Not kidding.
On purpose?
It's a major food staple everywhere except...
Everywhere except for the U.S., Canada, parts of Western Europe.
Uh-huh.
We're really the ones that are behind the times on that.
Also, why would anyone want to eat a cricket? Please explain that.
Yeah, so I will start with how and why, and then I will go into why.
More why.
You would eat the, yes, more why. I was living in Ireland for 4.5 years. I was an investment banker over there, traded equities derivatives for the National Bank of Canada.
But you're originally from Iowa. You are an Iowa girl through and through.
Yeah, went off to college in Philadelphia, played basketball in college, and then went over to Ireland with a program called Sport Changes Life, was lucky enough to get my master's at Trinity College in Dublin, started working in a bank, and didn't really...
Just an obvious trajectory for a farm girl.
Exactly. So I did that for a while, and then just, you know, last fall about this time was just really sick of it and said, you know, enough of this investment banking.
I think that's really important.
Yeah. It was one of those I wanted to build something and actually see, you know, that's the thing about growing up on a farm. Every year you plant something and you harvest something, so you get to see the work that you've applied. Whereas every day when I went in the office, sure, like we did a trade and I moved these fictitious buckets, I never saw that physical money. I never saw any of, you know, I didn't see any of that. So I came back in October of last year and started farming with my dad, traditional soybean, corn and soybeans kind of thing.
Were they surprised to have you make this decision?
I think they probably were, but they'd kind of been putting the bug in my ear for the previous about year and a half to come back. So I think, I don't know if I took it as a little bit of a joke at first and then, you know, started thinking about it and was like, well, you know, maybe I could do that. But so, yeah, it was growing up, I was not really one for all the chores and all of that kind of stuff and driving the tractors. That was more my brother's gig. Winter long, my dad said, you know, if you want to find a niche and go after that, you know, something more small scale than corn or soybeans, you don't want to fight what I've been doing for the last 30 years.
Was he thinking, well, I know with a lot of second, you know, when the second generation comes home and wants to farm, it's an issue. Is there enough land? How does the family support 2 farm incomes on the same amount of land? So you chose a really large project here.
The thing is, so I listen to a lot of podcasts, like Joe Rogan, Tim Ferriss, a couple of different fitness podcasts, and eating crickets and chapulines down in Mexico and all of that had come up a couple times. And so I started thinking, huh, maybe I could do that. And on the 1st of January, I sent my parents an article about another cricket farmer that's in Iowa called the Iowa Cricket Farmer that was run in the Des Moines Register. And I said, well, what about crickets? And they both kind of looked at me, well, like, what about crickets? And I said, huh. So, yeah, so by the 10th of January, I had 10,000 crickets, and here we are 7 months later.
Okay, give me an idea of how big 10,000 crickets are. Like,
so a pound of dry roasted crickets, so we have a half an ounce of dry roasted crickets here. A pound of these is about 3,000.
3,000, okay.
Yes. So 10,000 crickets, when I bought them, were
Baby crickets.
They were 2 weeks old. So they fit in a box that was about,
shoebox.
Yeah. About a shoebox size, easily. Okay. So not a whole lot of space. Mm-hmm. So I started out in two of these 18-gallon storage bins.
Well, thinking of dealing with small livestock, people have kept bees forever. Yep. Insects. Bees. Well, but we have learned to eat a whole lot of different protein sources. And why crickets? What is so good about the, besides being crunchy and yummy?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you bring up that, we've learned to eat all of these things. Crickets are actually the same family as lobster and shrimp as well. But why you'd want to eat crickets, they are 60% protein by dry weight. So that is double the protein of beef. They have more iron than spinach, more calcium than milk. They're a great source of vitamin B12. And then they have closer to the proper ratio of omega-6s to omega-3s. So the average American diet is somewhere around 20 to 1 on omega-6s to omega-3s. Omega-3s being the higher quality. These guys are a good option for that as well.
Little things. You eat the whole cricket.
You eat the whole cricket.
That's probably a good idea.
And what's the length of the life cycle of a cricket?
Yeah, so from egg to fully grown is generally about 8 weeks. Mm. So the max life cycle, they'll probably live to be about 10 weeks. And that's either in captivity or in the wild. They're only about a 10-week cycle.
In your flock, your herd.
Orchestra is actually the term.
Orchestra. Bravo. That's lovely.
In your orchestra of crickets, they are sustainable. They replicate themselves.
Yes.
That's
so
good.
You only had to buy one shoebox.
Yep, only the 10,000, and then since then I've been able to breed my own. So I've expanded my population. It's probably somewhere around 200,000. That being said, I killed a whole bunch of them, or harvested, rather, I suppose, a whole bunch of them yesterday. Uh-huh. But that being said, I do have a lot of babies that are hatching right now, so they're rapidly replacing.
Oh, how neat.
Yeah.
Well, what do you feed them?
Chicken feed.
Really?
Yes. But technically, you could feed them vegetable scraps. You could feed them all sorts of things. The reason that I do chicken feed is because it's dry, so I don't have as much of a mold issue. Whereas if I'm doing stuff that's, not dried out, if I'm doing vegetable scraps or something like that, then you have a little bit more of a mold issue and need to test some different feed blends and all of that kind of thing. But I'm so early in this that I was more concerned with having...
Keeping them alive?
Yes, exactly. Making them hatch, keeping them alive.
And you are going to learn as you go along.
Exactly.
We're around the Donna Luna kitchen table today with Shelby Smith, a small-scale farmer, a new farmer, a beginning farmer. She's growing protein for our market. She grows crickets. So we can learn to eat new things.
Yeah, that's our local cricket farmer. We can get that here in Ames. She is at the farmers markets in the summer. Mm-hmm. And if we find out she's selling her products somewhere else, we will let you know.
Yes, she has a business called Jiminy Crickets. And, you can eat them. And she came on our show a year or so ago and started talking about this. I guess she's going great guns. Insects. Like I said, we've been dealing with bees for centuries. And now that people have been eating insects for centuries. Here's a little...
besides crickets, people eat larvae.
Yeah.
Grubworms and things like that.
This is an article from magazine New Scientist. They just come up with just wonderful geeky things to write about here. And here is a... a project in the UK, in London, actually. They're growing the larva of
flies.
Oh,
in London. So this is urban farming.
It's urban farming. Mm. It's in the research stage now. But there's something called black soldier flies, and you don't eat the flies. The flies, actually, they are about the size of a house fly, but they don't bother anybody at all. Matter of fact, as adults, they don't bite anybody. They don't even eat. It's the larva that is the big deal. These are called soldier flies. The larva of these flies are the next big thing. They can be dried to feed to pets, or they can replace fish meal and all kinds of other stuff. And they can be swapped for all kinds of soy uses. They can be processed into a kind of plastic, baked into bread and biscuits, and mixed into ice cream. Now see? yum, yum, yum. Larva of flies.
Wait, so they want to put plastics in the bread? No.
No, no, not the... Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I think they'll get it
it's figured out. It's a multi-use
out.
Product.
They'll get it figured out here. And they eat, because these are larvas of flies, pre-consumer or post-consumer waste things, the products of eating, of existing food production. And they don't eat meat things, or at least you don't have to feed them meat things. Right now...
So they eat compost, of course.
Yeah, right now, with the... brewing leftovers from breweries and coffee grounds are kind of their food of choice.
Boy,
at least.
Well, we produce plenty of coffee grounds.
And believe it or not, they're going to start running out of that, and then they can go to other composty things. So there's insects. We're thinking of it. It might sound...
Yeah, insects, these are not novel proteins.
No,
these are things we have lived with for thousands of years. And they are just repurposing them, and I think that's a good bet for future food. I think it's safe, and I'm happy to eat those things.
Let's expand our horizon. Here's another little note. It might sound icky, but then most of us, including vegetarians, unknowingly eat fats and proteins from insects all the time because they're collected when crops are harvested. Even under FDA rules, frozen broccoli can include up to 60 whole aphids or mites per 100 grams. Now, we're talking tiny here, but it is part of our life. Bugs are with us, and actually, I think I read someplace on an overall scale, they outweigh us by a whole bunch of stuff on this planet.
But I have to add in, our insect populations are drastically in decline as well.
Well, we will be,
We'll have to start farming them.
Ooh, we will have to, too. Anyway, the idea of eating alternative foods, future, you always keep our mind open here and keep that idea of being a little humble and testing things out.
Testing
first.
new technologies.
Yeah, what are the benefits? What are the harms? Is new always better?
And let's stay tuned to find out what the nutritional quality is as much as we are technologically able to determine it.
That is true. So we talked about the future of food today. We have some upcomings to think about here. The Practical Farmers of Iowa annual conference is coming up January 16th through the 18th. And for more information on that, go to practicalfarmers.org.
It's an event stuff. That we love.
Because they deal with all sorts of good things.
In the food system.
Yep. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thanks for lending us your ears. We talked about food, future of food today. And as we heard from Shelby Smith, a small scale, very small scale, farmer of crickets here in Iowa, the word for today is orchestra. Orchestra is the term you use for a group of crickets. Like a gaggle of geese, it's an orchestra of crickets.
Aww.
Isn't that nice? So that is your word for the day.
Yeah, like you don't have a word for a group of cultured meat cells, do you?
Well, we'll work on that, Donna. Oh. All right. We had music today by the band Fluke from their CD Haven. You've heard the tunes Padrex, Austrian's Way, and as a footnote here, the last tune we're going out with is called Wrong Foot Forward. Just a little comment.
Start
there.
Start your new year with the wrong foot forward.
Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Cynthia McClure. Eat good food and enjoy life.